we were. We have two budget notes. And what I plan to do is look at both of these budget notes, and we'll move them one at a time. The first budget note to the Secretary of State's budget regards the meeting that Senator Dukes and Representative Butler had discussion about the CNE forms, and to direct the Secretary of State to make them, hopefully make them easier to understand. I visited with the Secretary of State this morning. He has a new Director of Elections coming on board that hopefully Senator Dukes and Representative Butler will have time to visit with. Any questions or further discussion on the budget note, the first budget note that we have in front of us? Any objection to that budget note? If not, so moved. And the second budget note, Representative Butler, or Representative Butler, would you like to speak to that?
Happy to, Madam Chair. There is a concern relative to consistency and amounts and the application of fines, and the second and separate budget note would be a requirement for the Secretary of State to report to the next assembly on the contribution expenditure forms, fines, and penalties assessed and waived, and the standards and criteria applied for the waivers themselves.
Discussion. Representative Johnson.
Having never had a fine or a penalty assessed or waived, I'm curious about the waiver procedure. I didn't know that fines were waived.
And Senator Dukes, Madam Chair, Senator Dukes had had certain circumstances where the death of a treasurer may waive a fine, but the death of a telephone line will not. And so this is to try and see whether or not there's some policy and consistency, and then based upon that report by the Secretary of State's office, then perhaps in the next assembly, if there is a policy that could be recommended by the Secretary of State's office to be acted upon.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
I don't disagree with the basic philosophy behind this, but the tone of this note seems to suggest that there's a capriciousness in the Secretary of State's office where there might be subjective judgments made about processes that I think are guided by some policy, and my concern is just the tone of the note.
Representative Hayden, do you wish to address that?
Yes, that specific point, Madam Chair. It's my understanding, and I have read election law, that there is, in fact, discretion allowed to the Secretary of State and to the elections officer. The terminology is may, not shall, and they may exercise direction. In point of fact, it's my experience that I'm not aware of times when they do exercise discretion when I think that they should have. For example, the fiber optic line being broken, perhaps a death in the family. I think they have hewed too vigorously to the law of the Medes and the Persians.
I don't understand what that
means. You don't understand that?
Sorry, no.
That they have hewed too strictly to the absolute letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. And so I would urge Secretary of State to exercise their discretion more frequently rather than less frequently.
Senator Dukes.
That's actually a statutory issue. We could statutorily tell them what they can and can't waive. I would prefer not to do that, but we have the ability to do that. If I recall correctly, there's an appeal panel. You file an appeal. Well, my treasurer died and we couldn't find the stuff, the data. And we missed the deadline and got a notice we were going to get fined. We appealed and wrote the letter and said, you know, this is what all went on. And some review panel said that was enough grounds to waive our being fined. And so I don't know who's on that panel. I mean, this was many years ago. But I guess I'm just a little bit nervous, assuming that review panel was in some way impartial and fair, to tell them not to stick to the letter of the law. Because I might like this decision, but I might not like the next two. And they would say, but you told us not to stick to the letter of the law. That makes me nervous.
Madam Chair.
Representing Gardner, and then I'll go to Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my comment is simply that I don't see what fails to stop any member from walking down the hall and asking for policies and procedures in these particular lists of fines and assessments, which all would be public record to begin with, rather than requiring an actual report, you know, which has a cost and an allocation of staff time and everything else to create, when the information is probably just readily available by walking down the hall.
I have Representative Butler, and then I'll go to Representative Witt.
Madam Chair, this request for a report speaks to the standards and criteria applied, and to the extent that there is any degree of discretion, I think that it's appropriate that we know how that is applied, how those standards and criteria are in fact applied.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's appropriate that some discretion is given to the Secretary of State's office relative to fines. I think the situation that Senator Dukes has had is a perfect example of that. So in view of the fact that it is appropriate to give some discretion in terms of fines and the waiver of fines, then I think it's also most appropriate that a report is prepared to the legislature to show how that discretion was exercised. And I don't think this is a matter of simply walking down the hall and seeing who was fined and who wasn't fined and what waivers were given. So we're asking for more than that here. We're asking for a thorough report that also talks about the standards and the criteria that applies to waivers. In view of the fact that this involves the entire legislative body and other candidates, and that some discretion is appropriate, I don't think we're asking too much here to have a report prepared that shows the fines and the waivers and what criteria was used.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion on this budget note? Okay. Any objections? So we'll take a little break and go ahead and are you going to be ready to move the
budget?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Chair.
After we have moved this budget, I'm going to ask the Secretary of State to come up. He wanted to make some comment for the record, so I appreciate you staying here until we get through with this. Good morning, Senator Hannan.
Good morning.
Representative Butler, would you like to go ahead with your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, at this time, relative to the Secretary of State's budget, which is House Bill 5040, I make a motion that we approve the budget at $39,250,178 and a total of 207 positions or 206.67 full-time equivalency, and recognize that of that budget amount, that the parts of the sum of the parts is greater than the whole by $213,656, which is the portion that the governor has basically, which is an unspecified general fund reduction, and it remains unspecified. It belongs to the Secretary of State to identify where that will be allocated amongst the eight departments that he administers.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler. So the recommendation, as I understand it, then is for general fund
of $11,029,034.
Mm-hmm.
Other funds of $28,054,465. $1 of federal funds. Non-limited other of $166,678. For a total of $39,250,178, 207 positions with 206.67 full-time equivalency.
Thank you.
Set. Alan, mesh with what you have?
We needed the detail for the bill. Thank you, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Any discussion?
I was going to ask the secretary a question when he got out, but I'm going to be a no on this budget, and for over one position. Currently, I think we all acknowledge that the Secretary of State is running the elections division with the minimum number that he needs to make that function, and there's no reason to think that we're going to be able in this session to change his the workload in the elections division, that there will still be a whole lot of initiative petitions that the all of the elections that he certifies for around the state will continue to go on in large form, that we'll all go out there and recruit lots of candidates, and so that the workload is going to continue. And he's meeting those obligations with a temporary position today, and for all the right reasons, the legislature said you don't keep temporary positions going on forever. And in denying him a permanent position for that, I think we jeopardize his ability to fulfill his legal obligations that we have set in place in statute. And I'm happy to cut budgets, and I'll take on his budget, and we have. But I don't think that we have the right to ask an elected official to try to perform below his legal obligations without telling him what it is we don't want him to do. And we're not proposing to do that. And in elections, I didn't think we could. So I fully believe that this one will be funded at some point, and that is the co-chair's intent. And I credit them for letting the secretary choose his cuts. I can't vote to fund an agency below what I believe is required to meet their legal requirements, especially since we just put a budget out the other day that had a whole lot of extras in it, general fund extras, in order to try to help agencies work and meet their obligations. And I think that this budget is telling him that he needs to meet all of those statutory requirements, but we're not going to give him what he needs to do it with, and I'm just not comfortable doing that. And a lot of this may stem from my past and my years in elections, but I just can't get there, and I don't mean to be critical of anyone in doing this. It's just I'm not going to be able to get there.
Thank you, Senator Dukes. And I had Representative Hayden and then Representative Johnson.
Well, Madam Chair, the voter's pamphlet is near and dear to my heart, and I think many of my colleagues share that. I think it's one of the finer things that the elections office does, and I look forward to it every session, whether or not I'm personally involved. There's a wealth of information there, and I save them year after year and go back and refer to them. So I would, of course, hope the Secretary of State could get the voter's pamphlet out in a timely manner, and I hope that we have not brought them too close to the bone that they would be unable to do that. I do view as a hopeful note the fact that the total funds increase is 9.9% above current service level, and that we have funded package 171 generously. And it was my understanding during the presentation the Secretary of State said that they had been able to hold the line on FTE over the years due to their efficiencies from technology. It's my hope that as we do fund the technology with Program Option Package 171, and as we do fund the budget 9.9% above current service level, that they would be able to meet their statutory duties. And so I will vote yes on this budget.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair. I am also not afraid to cut budgets. I'm going to join Senator Dukes in voting no for many of the same reasons that Senator Dukes articulated, but I would also like to add that by the addition of two budget notes today, we're asking the Secretary of State's Elections Division to discharge more obligations and perform more work without giving them the support they need to do that. With the national scrutiny on our election system, Oregon's national model of mail-in, The fact that elections this last time around were not without considerable difficulties, I think if we are to maintain high standards in that important function in the Secretary of State's office, we need to give the Secretary the tools to do it. So I'm joining Senator Dukes over one position, particularly looking back against what we did with the Department of Administrative Services. I understand the rationale behind the co-chair's direction, but I feel that the Elections Division is a pivotal, highly scrutinized part of the Secretary's portfolio with huge public expectations of absolute performance, and I don't feel right denying him the tools to do that.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Gardner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to sound like a chorus, but I happen to agree with Senator Dukes and Representative Johnson that we're continuing to add more workload to the Secretary of State's Elections Division tremendously, not only through budget notes as mentioned before, but also given the Attorney General's opinion on not being able to take campaign, on the ability to take campaign contributions by candidates. We've also got bills, the one that's passed through the Senate, heading through the House, that requires additional contribution and expenditure reports, that requires additional duties and times. Certainly there are efficiencies through technology, but there's also additional tasks due to technology as well, making all of those available on websites, et cetera, and to not fund the part-time positions currently there that's needed, necessary, for the public's knowledge in these areas, to have all those information available, I'll be a no today as well.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hannan.
Madam Chair, on behalf of the co-chairs, I understand our colleagues on the other side of the aisle. I certainly appreciate your view. However, yesterday, the co-chairs issued a policy statement of the co-chairs, and I believe some members are in possession of that statement, that we are developing budgets predicated on trying to embrace the governor's proposed reductions as much as possible, and passing out bills and bipartisan means to the floor in both the House and the Senate, with the understanding that somewhere along the line, towards the end of the session, there will be discussion on bringing back other issues to provide us additional resources. But predicated upon the shortness of the revenue forecast that's due to be disclosed next Thursday, a week from today, and the uncertainty of what may happen on the May forecast, we feel it's compelling for us as members to bring forth budgets that have addressed the proposed reductions that the governor has proposed, with certainly the idea of coming back at a later moment in time, hopefully not too distant, to discuss other options of adding back. The co-chairs had the Secretary of State in this morning and met with him. The Secretary of State fully understands our position on this. It's not a partisan issue. It's not an attempt to inflict more workload on the Secretary of State's office and not properly fund positions. As a matter of fact, one of the issues we discussed was the subcommittee's action of coming up with some additional cost savings in the audit division that the Secretary of State's office has recommended to the subcommittee, and using some of those savings to fund this election position. So we are fully prepared and committed to fund this elections position at the proper time that resources become available. But we would ask our colleagues on the other side of the aisle to join us in developing a compatible add-back list. From day one, the governor has said this is a bipartisan legislature. The co-chairs responded by developing a co-chair's budget in response to the governor. Since that time, the co-chairs have extended the olive branch to our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, asking you for your ideas and input and suggestions and adding back issues. And we continue that effort to do so. And this is in no way an attempt by the co-chairs to ramrod any budget out of this subcommittee to the floor of either the Senator or the House and embarrass anybody by putting them out on a branch and then sawing the branch off behind them. This is an attempt to come up with a responsible address on the budget and then come up with a sincere, honest, bipartisan attempt down the road to add back resources, to add back these positions. This is not a decision that was arrived at lightly. The co-chairs have spent a lot of time discussing this, and I understand my colleagues' concern, but I would respectfully suggest that we have tried to do this in a bipartisan way, and for that reason, I'm here to help the subcommittee move this process along.
Thank you, Senator, and we appreciate your work in, as one of the co-chairs. And having sat on budgets before in different capacity, being on the other side of the aisle when we've developed budgets, I know that the people in charge have a huge responsibility. And when it comes down to where we have to make these kind of cuts, which hurt us, or the kinds of cuts like for Oregon Project Independence, any of the cuts we'll be faced in making, especially if our forecast is low, it's not going to be fun for any of us. Any further comments, Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, I deeply appreciate what you said, and I know my colleagues appreciated Representative Westland coming and speaking with us this morning. You alluded to the fact that there was a policy statement that the co-chairs had developed that some folks were in possession of. Is it possible to see that policy? Maybe that would help some of us that are struggling, particularly as newcomers, understand where the co-chairs are headed and have a...
Momentarily, hang on just a moment and I'll get it.
Thank you.
Magic.
It's a server.
Magic paper or the deliverer.
Let it never be said that the co-chairs are not responsive.
And never let it be said that they're probably not watching our every move. Any further discussion?
Thank you.
The clerk will.
I just wanted to say that I agree very much, Mr. Co-Chair, that this has not been a partisan process, and we appreciate that a lot. And I don't expect that it will become one. And I know my actions today are not partisan. They come in part from my background, and we will from time to time disagree. And as far as I'm concerned, that's all this is today, is a disagreement. This is an important issue to me, and I have one vote to cast, and I will cast it based on that, but it is by no means a partisan issue to me.
Thank you, Senator Dukes. I think I hear you say that it's one thing to disagree, but another thing to be disagreeable, and we're not disagreeing.
And if we hit partisan points, you'll know.
Yes.
I would certainly hope so.
I think as long as Senator Hannon's been here, which is... wonderful that you have the experience you do, that you probably will recognize if anything is partisan.
Have you noticed how hard they try not to call us old timers, but they manage to do it anyway? It's only four of us left here.
Yes. I'm not
careful.
Exactly. Representative Butler has called for the question. We're ready for the question. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Senator
Duke?
No.
Senator Quirrell?
Aye.
Senator Quinn? Aye. Motion is carried. Senate Bill, House Bill 5040 is adopted. the, now I need a motion to move it to the full committee with the dissent.
Madam Chair, I make a motion at this time to move this House Bill 5040 to the full Ways and Means, Joint Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any objection? So ordered. Representative...
That was a yes.
Pardon me?
I was meaning to object over here.
Please note, Senator Duke, please, an objection. We need to have a carrier of this bill on the House side, or to the full. Representative Butler will do that, and will you do that as well in the House?
Yes.
Okay. And I'll carry it in the Senate. With that, we'll close the work... Oops, we can't close...
Yeah, we can close the work session, ma'am.
But I want Senator, Secretary, Mr. Secretary of State, and I will close the work session so we can excuse the co-chairs. We'll close the work session and leave the record open for Secretary of State to come up and address it.
Also, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's one other item on the agenda following this budget bill. We need to acknowledge receipt of a report from the Public Employees Retirement System.
So if you'll wait after the Secretary made his report, because we need to open the public hearing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Bradbury, Secretary of State. Let me first say that it's been a pleasure appearing before this committee, and I've appreciated the consideration that's been given. I had a good meeting this morning, and I appreciated the efforts the co-chair has made to bring me in so that there were no surprises this morning, and I appreciate that. I think it's important for everyone to recognize that this is, in fact, a budget reduction, and it's $200,000 about of general fund that we now have to figure out where that comes from. And the places it can come from are elections, audits, our elections, archives, or the executive office. And so the question becomes, the question that I have to answer with this budget is, what don't we do that we're now doing? So I just want to make that clear. There's a couple of things that I would like to speak to in terms of what I hope would be on this subcommittee's list for improvement or add back if that comes to pass. And the first thing, obviously, is the issue that has Senator Dukes and other members concerned, and that is the temporary position in elections that's basically we depend on that person, and we're going to get to a point in July where we're going to have to let that person at least break service for a little while to maintain temp, and we know we can't do our current service work without that position. So that's our number one priority, and the other two priorities are both in elections, and one is to get a programmer in there from that would be IS, that would be funding to IS, but it would be a programmer who would work with elections, and then the third thing would be to do the non-disclosure, the part of non-disclosure, because we don't have, I mean, really, the way non-disclosure works right now is we have court orders not to disclose people's names, addresses, phone numbers, and it's really sort of by memory in the elections division, and that's not okay, and we need to get that addressed. And so, I mean, there's some real public safety concerns about things, people who have, not enforcement orders, but restraining orders on them that aren't supposed to get certain information. So that would be, those would be the things that I would want on the list. And I want to just, in response to one of the comments Representative Hayden offered, yes, there are other fund improvements in the budget, particularly as it relates to technology, which I'm very appreciative of. But I want to be real clear that those other fund improvements in technology do not, underline not, benefit the elections division. The elections division is an entirely general funded division, and it would be inappropriate to use other funded positions to assist in elections improvements. So the improvements that are being made in the budget related to technology are other funded areas like audits and the rest, and they're not in elections. So we, with the current budget, we absolutely will not see technology improvements in the elections part of the budget. So I just want to be clear about that. We don't get the improvement by funding it somewhere else.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And I would just add to, we have appreciated your testimony this last week. You bring a bit of humor to our committee, and we appreciate that because it's not always an easy committee to serve on when you have to cut budgets. And I appreciate that the co-chairs have stayed in here and listened to your concerns as well and met with you this morning. And I have your priorities as you gave them to me, and those will be in that priority on our advent list. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just one other comment. I really appreciate meeting with the co-chairs this morning, and I fully understand the situation that all of us are faced with in this budget. So it's not, I get it. And I certainly don't feel that this is any, there's no partisanship being, it's basically a new policy about how the budgets are going to move, and I understand that. And I appreciate our conversation. So.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing and work session on the preliminary report on earnings distribution. Good morning.
Good morning.
Have you been told about our pig?
In fact, Madam Chairman, in the spirit of, reserving for future liabilities.
Yes.
There you go.
Madam Chair, I'm starting to wonder if we really ought to give that money to the Cancer Society, if we ought to just up the ante and see if we can bail out the budget.
That's a possibility. Maybe we need two pigs.
First day, Hayden and I were planning on having a big good sale in Rotunda every Friday to work towards bailing out the general fund budget.
Here, are you guys going to cook or bake?
I don't know about that.
We wouldn't be able to raise anybody.
I'll help. Okay, good morning. If you'd like to introduce yourself, or Dallas, do you need to speak to this first? I don't mean to be rushing you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, briefly, just by statute, public employees' retirement system is required to report to the appropriate legislative group of its preliminary distribution of earnings before it can finalize that distribution. It intends to finalize distribution at its board meeting in March, and so it's here to submit its report to this subcommittee.
Good morning. If you'll introduce yourself to the record, please. And
good morning. Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Voitko. I'm the Executive Director of PERS, and I'm accompanied by Dale Orr, our Chief Financial Officer, and Sarah Gates from DASBAM. The LFO officer said today, we are here to execute our statutory responsibility to report to the legislature 30 days before the final crediting decision by the PERS board for the year 2000. Our written report to you was submitted on February 16th. I should say, as by way of background, that while we are required to report to you, my understanding of the statute is that it's for the purposes of this committee offering comment back that I would take back to the PERS board, the statute does not vest power to change that decision at this particular session. Let me say that there were three crediting decisions that the PERS board made on a preliminary basis on February 13th at a public meeting. I want to stress for a moment that these are preliminary. The final numbers may change, although we anticipate that they would change only slightly. There are a number of reasons for that, but the main reason is that there are a number of investments in the actual fund that are private equity investments, and they don't always get priced on a daily or even weekly basis. So sometimes the numbers can shift slightly. Those three crediting decisions that the board made on February 13th were that 8% is credited to Tier 1 regular accounts and related reserves. Earnings were insufficient to cover that 8%. In fact, earnings only covered 0.23% in the year 2000 of that 8%. We're required to credit 8% by statute. So the remaining 7.77% was drawn from the gain-loss reserve and credited to those regular accounts. The second crediting decision was to credit 0.2% to Tier 2 regular accounts and their related reserves. This represents actual regular account earnings, and there were no reserves involved in that crediting decision. And for variable accounts, the board credited a negative 3.22% to those accounts and their related reserves, reflecting what was a very poor year, as I think we all know, in the investment markets. That is really the sum and substance of my report. If there are any other questions that I can answer or my colleagues can answer, we're certainly prepared to do so.
Questions? Senator Dukes.
Vice Chair, there are probably a lot of words to use for this, just a lack of knowledge or understanding a lot of this. How do you do a minus 3.22? Do their accounts actually lose money?
Yes, in fact.
Where does that money go to?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, it's very much like the way a person's 401k would go down in value. The investments held in those accounts actually declined in value over the course of the year. So that it's not so much that the investments have gone away, but when we marked their value at the end of the year, it was 3.22% less than it was at the beginning of the year.
This is a paper number that would only take real value if somebody were to retire at the moment.
That's correct.
Okay.
It's very similar to your own personal account. That there's a difference between the paper value at any given point in time in your house or your personal account and when you actually try to convert it to cash.
Representative Hayden and then Representative Witt.
Well, you know, as you know, the First System has done very well in its investment in equities over the years, over the last several decades. And I see the gentleman from Associated Oregon County sitting in the back. As I understand it, one of the problems with them is that they have not been able to invest in equities, so they can't keep up with the amount of money they need to fund municipal funds and so on. And yet, we're investing in equities and we're losing money. Aren't they better off than we are?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, two points I'd make in response to your question. The first is that while these numbers may seem poor, they're in fact very, very good relative to what the market indices did. And that's not my opinion. That's a quantitative fact. This represents excellent performance on the part of the OIC which I also sit on, in the investment of the PERS funds. The second issue you raise, I believe, is concerning the employer's ability to invest side by side with the employees in the variable account. And that was an issue that came before the legislature, I believe, in the last session. The board, and there was no action, if I recall correctly, the board, advised by DOJ, felt that it had the authority and it was fiscally prudent, actuarially prudent, to, in fact, put in place a rule that required side-by-side investments of like kind, meaning variable in employee and also variable to that same amount in employer. That is now current practice at PERS, so that is an issue that we think is in the rearview mirror. There are other issues with PERS, as I'm sure you're aware, but I don't believe that that's one of them at the current time.
Very good figure speech, Madam Chair. Follow-up. Well, in hindsight, of course, had we invested in money funds, in cash funds, we would have been plus four instead of minus three, but that's in the rearview mirror. I like that very much. So what do we do in the future? Do we continue just to invest as wisely and pray that in the long term the stock market will continue its historic 10% increase? Or
Perhaps this is a self-serving comment, Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, but since I sit on the OIC, but I believe the OIC's asset allocation to stocks, private equity, bonds, and other types of investments is both very prudent, is done in a very sound manner, and also one has to remember that these investments are very, very large, so moving them around quickly is extremely expensive and potentially very risky. In fact, we're very reluctant to make massive quick changes in our asset allocation, and all of our advisors advise that would be an imprudent way to run the fund. Second point I would make is that these funds are being invested with a 40 or 50-year horizon. That is, we have to look out. These are not there just to make money for this year. They're there to pay a stream of obligations that goes out quite a long time. And so that that liability and the nature of it requires a different kind of stable asset allocation policy that in fact does suggest a healthy reliance on the long-term returns that are available in equities and have been historically. Whether or not they performed well in the last 6 months or 12 months is not especially relevant to that decision.
I appreciate that explanation, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Voitka, what happens if we have another 1 or 2 years like the year 2000? The gain loss reserve dropped precipitously last year. What happens if we go and we don't have any gain loss reserve and we're still legislatively required to provide the 8% return to regular accounts that are in Tier 1?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, let me answer that question in two parts. The current status of the gain loss reserve is that the board has a policy of 30 months. That is enough money to carry the 8% that is guaranteed by statute for 30 months. With the drawdown that has taken place, we are at approximately 10 months remaining. So that in answer to your question, if we were to have no earnings in our various investments in the stock and bond markets this year, we would in fact eat up all the remaining gain loss reserve. And then the second part of the question is what then happens? Under statute, we then book the 8% anyway, and then debit what's called the deficit account, which is in essence a negative version of the gain loss reserve. And it is money that that doesn't yet exist. We have to hope that in future years there are opportunities where the fund earns more than the guarantee so that we can, in essence, claw back that money. The statute requires us that if we run a deficit position and in a subsequent year we do earn, say, 9%, which is a percent above our 8% guarantee, that 100% of that extra 1% has to be clawed back until the deficit is wiped out. After that point, the PERS board's discretion about how much to put in a positively funded gain loss reserve takes over.
Follow up, Madam Chair. In view of the very high returns the last several years, regular accounts Tier 1 have been getting earnings of 15% to 25%, I believe. I mean, was it imprudent not to fully fund the gain loss reserve in those good times so that we're not now looking at a situation where we could go into a deficit within the next year or year and a half?
Well, let me answer your question again in two parts, Madam Chair, Representative Wood. The first question is, what were the crediting decisions over the past 5 years? And I don't believe that, did we ever credit, Dale, if I may consult my colleague, in excess of 20% to regular accounts? I think 20% in the year 1999 was the peak. But it is true, so I'm not sure that we... 21% was the peak. Not as high as 25, but in fact well in excess. It's a fact that we credited well in excess of the 8% guarantee. The question as to whether or not it was imprudent is a question, in fact, that we are currently doing a substantial amount of work on. It's not so much that we're looking backwards and saying, was that imprudent? That's hark back to a comment I made to Representative Hayden, that's in the rearview mirror. The real question is, where do we stand today and what should we do going forward? We're taking two tacks on that question to get at the heart of, I think, the spirit of your question. The first is that we have hired an actuarial auditor and specifically targeted their work toward the issue of how fast the liability growth for Tier 1 money match liabilities, that is what the fund has to fund in the future, actually is. The long-time assessment of that is 8.5%, which, as you can see, is higher than the guarantee, and it's because Tier 1 never gets less than the guarantee, but as you pointed out, Representative, it often gets more in those years where money is available. The question is whether that 8.5% assumption correctly captures what the likely future activity of the board and the stock markets and bond markets are likely to be. The second thing is that we have also spent the last 8 or 9 months building a simulation model that attempts to, in fact, in part, it tries to address many things, but it tries to address exactly the spirit of your question. We are not yet at the point where I can give you an answer as to whether or not I think that the staff would be recommending to the PERS board a significant difference, different policy tack toward using the game loss reserve in the future. But there's much active work going on in that area as we speak.
Any further questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two issues. One relative to the, and I think Representative Witt got to the heart of the game loss reserve. When the board acted, and very prudently acted, to move the game loss reserve to a 30-month, two-and-a-half-year game loss reserve from a one-and-a-half-year, there was great hue and cry over the fact that folks thought that was a terrible conversion and theft of their money. Is there any discussion amongst the board at this time to come back and address that now that we've seen that the market can have some downside, address that 30-month goal, funding goal, and perhaps take a look at a longer funding goal based upon the hired actuarial auditor's recommendation?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, two things with respect to your question. First is the board does not have before it a specific action item regarding reconsideration of the 30-month goal. Keep in mind that the goal is one thing, but how much money is in the reserve is really the item that matters. The goal is a guideline that that informs the board as to, you know, how much money it would like to put into the game loss reserve and at what time. The second thing, though, is that while that issue is not currently slated for specific address, it is being addressed, and not so indirectly, through the work that the board has supported by the staff with respect to the two projects that I mentioned to Representative Witt a moment ago.
Second question.
Yes,
thank you. On the summary of the report, the analysis by Ms. Gates, the discussion indicates that the regular account earned 0.20, and I noticed that the 0.20 is used in a couple of places, and you had said 0.23 was 7.77% from the gain loss ratio. Can you explain that difference?
I'll do my best, Madam Chair, Representative Butler. The 0.23 and the 0.20 apply to two different parts of the pension system. The 0.23 applies only to the Tier 1 portion of the system. Keep in mind that we have a very complex system in which employees are layered with different rules, if pension rules applying to them, if you will. And in the Tier 2 area, the number was 0.20. So there's a slight difference, and you know, I'm hard pressed to tell you where the 0.03% actually are rooted in, but I think it has to do with respect to the fact that the gain loss reserve actually, as long as it's positively funded, throws off earnings to the Tier 1 members, so that they benefited from it in two ways this year. One is that it was available to draw down to meet their guarantee, but also the gain loss reserve has no right to its own earnings. And so those earnings are, in essence, handed back and available to be distributed to Tier 1 members on an annual basis.
Final question, Madam Chair. Thank you. Relative to the actuarial auditor that's been hired, was the charge given to the auditor himself or herself given to examine any of the issues relative to the existing tiers and the existing variable regular account issues and any future potential changes as to a Tier 3 and or the weight of Tier 1 at 8% that may cause some additional grief at a later time?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the charge to the actuarial auditor was to do a concurrent, meaning alongside the systems actuary, review of the actuary's policies, procedures, practices, and assumptions. But those would only relate to those tiers or parts of the pension system that were currently in statute. So they were not asked to opine on Tier 3 or any other proposals that might change the current status. The same thing is true, I might add, for the simulation work that we've done. It is all based on current practice. And again, the two pieces of work really go hand in hand toward addressing this issue of what is the future liability stream that would emerge from Tier 1 money match. It turns out to be an extraordinarily complex question, much more complex than I had envisioned when I first arrived here 10 months ago.
Can I just ask one more question?
Yes,
I know Representative Hayden's back in the queue here, but this loss in the variable account from a very small addition to the regular account, Tier 1 and Tier 2, how much closer does that bring our local municipalities back in line with what they have to raise of unfunded mandate?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, let me understand your question. Is the issue, how does it affect any existing unfunded actuarial liability that exists in the state and local community part of the pool and or its rates? I can make some general comments about that issue.
General comments about the rates is primarily what I'm at.
The effect of drawing down the gain loss reserve and the returns that are below the actuarial assumption, not just in Tier 1, but also the actuarial assumption that embeds the people who are already retired, will, all other things being equal, and we think that that's likely to be the case, will tend to put upward pressure on employer rates. Anytime we earn less than the long-term actuarial assumption, unless there's some other offsetting factor out there, it will tend to have an upward pressure on rates. In particular, the practice for some time has been to count the entire gain loss reserve as available to meet system liabilities. And with its drawdown and some of it being put in directly into the liability stream, it actually has a double effect on reducing the amount of assets available for employers to meet their obligations. And the end result will be some pressure upward on rates, but I can't quantify it at the present time, sir.
If you would stand by a minute, what we're going to do, I'm sure I opened a work session on this, didn't I? If not, we are in a work session, and we need to acknowledge receipt of this report and have a quorum, and I would like to do that now. And we'll continue the questions, and I want to let Senator Hannan get back to his duties.
Moving to acknowledge receipt of the report.
Anyone object? Not so moved. Thank you, Senator Hannan. Please continue. Now, I had Representative Hayden, and I had Representative...
I was just going to do what he did.
Okay. Representative Hayden.
Thank you,
Representative Witt, for staying.
Just very briefly, Madam Chair, could somebody for me carry this chart across for the whatever's most convenient, if I could have the estimated figures or the final figures after the March 23rd meeting?
Oh, sir.
Or maybe those estimated figures are available now for that, for the line 2000B.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, it would be 0.23, I think, available for Tier 1,
point 0.20
for Tier
That's correct.
2, and variable minus 3.22. Those are the earnings that are available, but they are distributing out of the gain loss reserves to make the Tier 1 members' accounts and reserves receive the 8%.
All right, so that's the actual return is 0.23, but it would be for Tier 1 earnings, it would be... 8%?
8%.
That's good correct. Distribution.
But all the others would be, as you told me.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions? And I certainly didn't mean to cut you off, Representative Butler. I just needed to get that done.
Thank you very much.
No questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Sarah, we did need to hear from you. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Sarah Gates, but I didn't acknowledge receipt of the report and get it done.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. And what are we doing Monday, Dallas?
Right.
I think we're doing, I'm not sure what we're doing. Where are we?
It's not an agency that I have responsibility for.
I think it's, I forgot to bring my list. I think we're doing the Commission on Women and...
Oh, yes. Exactly.
Commission on Women and Commission on... Black Affairs and Commission on Hispanic
Affairs. Yeah, the commissions are next.
Okay, that we are adjourned.
They came in and assured me that they had switched their emphasis from...